soon be leaving rock and roll forever, donating it to our children, its real owners, but we didn't yet know it. Soon we would be able to tolerate only the music we'd grown up with, big band and jazz and classical. Nothing else would be able to penetrate our aging skulls. What were we talking about that night? It was the 24-hour Nixon channel back then. All Nixon, all the time. The paranoid and fleshy Bassett face. The fallout from the Watergate break-in. The elaborate White House gavotte. The living room was divided into clusters, and from each of those clusters an occasional name was spat out like hot oil from Tasha Bresner's pan. Haldeman. Ehrlichman. For laughs, Martha Mitchell, with her mouth that wouldn't shut up. We despised these figures, and yet we followed their horrific antics with a certain feverishness. Here it was, Hanukkah, wintertime, only 8 months before Nixon and poor, bony, hesitant Pat would leave the White House lawn. Men's ties were wide as roads then, and the hair of male writers and college professors was still slightly long, or else overly wide, formed into the topiary that became informally known as the Jewish Afro. There were, for the record, no black people in the room. We had known some well in the 60s, during the civil rights movement, and later on there had been the occasional black writer who would appear in someone's living room, but they drifted away from our world, or else had been cut loose. Wives wore dresses of indigo and maroon, and beaded necklaces from Central America. Most of them worked now, having grabbed jobs or graduate degrees as though there were a big game of musical chairs taking place, and they needed to be gainfully employed before the music stopped. Into this room I brought a new platter of potato pancakes. "Food," I announced, and people came from their separate groups and ate, taking the latkes with their hands, happily burning their tongues. When Tasha finally ducked into the room, she was greeted with applause and responded shyly, pinkening from this brief moment of attention, which represented the smallest fraction of the amount of attention her husband received in a single day. She looked too happy to me, so happy that she might split, and she ran her hands up and down the sides of her dress, murmuring to herself. "You're a genius, Tasha," said a garrulous man named Belstein, whose novels all followed the life of a character named Felstein. He gave her a kiss on the top of her head, where the hair was pulled into a dark, gleaming ball. Someone else handed her a drink, and she stayed for a while and drank, which was unusual for this woman, who liked to scurry off into corners where she would not be seen. She was like one of the endless series of hamsters that had lived in our children's rooms. When you tried to pay attention to those animals, to touch them or show them affection, they scrammed into one of the tube tunnels that had been installed in their cages. The kitchen was often Tasha Bresner's tunnel, but tonight she had emerged from its heat and its damp surfaces, just in time for what would turn out to be the famous fight between the two famous husbands. It started as these things seemed to, out of virtually nothing. A bit of casual talk, a string of political remarks, and some lightweight dismissal of an overrated non-fiction writer. "Did you see that picture in the paper last week?" Joe asked. "His nostrils were huge. I bet he keeps entire reams of paper up there." "Who cares about his nostrils?" said Lev. "You're making fun of the man physically? You're saying his nose, it is too big?" "Well, he's an arrogant ass," said Joe. "The nostrils make him look snobbish, as though he had them deliberately carved, enlarged, to give him an aristocratic look. His books are so false, Lev, even you can see it." "What do you mean, even me? Am I so dense I am handicapped from seeing the truth about a writer?" "Yeah, this particular writer, I seem to recall you have a blind spot about," Joe went on. "You always defend him for some reason."
"He is my lover,"
Lev deadpanned, the back of his hand to his forehead, and the circle of writers and editors laughed. These men had no homosexual blood. Oh no, not them. No homosexuality, no hemophilia. Nothing rarefied about them whatsoever. "He's not your lover," said Joe quickly. "He's your fucking brother in the Talmud." There was quiet in the room.
"What?"
asked Lev. He was reassessing Joe, taking his measure. This happened once in a while between Lev and other writers. I'd witnessed it before, but had never seen it between him and Joe. Nothing, muttered Joe.
No, tell me.
All right. You know you tend to favor other Jews. You know you do, Joe went on. It's a fact about you. I accept it. Look, this isn't some anti-Semitic gotcha moment, Lev, so don't try to turn it into one.
But Lev kept at him, trying to parse his words, and Joe rose up, uncoiled, and soon the men were shouting at each other, smearing each other's work.
Joe was full of shit, said Lev, a pretender to the throne of big fucking American writer.
And Lev, said Joe, was using his concentration camp childhood like a free pass into important places.
Fuck you, said Lev.
No, fuck you, said Joe. And then Lev slugged him. Joe staggered, but wasn't badly hurt. Anyone could see that. This wasn't fatal. No teeth were loosened or lost, and no lip was split, spilling blood in a dramatic but benign way. The lip, oh, the lip. So melodramatic with its endless blood, but no one ever died of a broken lip. Still, the blood flowed, and it frightened Joe after he brought his hand to his mouth and it came back brightly shining. He struck back, and the men fought each other sloppily, slapping, punching, kicking, calling each other names. You little shit, you fraud, you prick, you asshole, you. And then Joe added, you know what? I'd like to see you write one novel, Lev, just one, in which you aren't allowed to use the following keys on your typewriter. H-O-L-O-C-A-U-S-T. As the other guests watched, fascinated and appalled, the two writers fell into one of the bedrooms together. It was the Bresner's younger daughter's room, with pink walls and a canopy bed, and Lev and Joe both ended up on that bed, landing on an oasis of pointy-footed, half-nude Barbie dolls. Thank God our own children had refused to come to this party, saying it was boring and there was no one their age to talk to. Everyone crowded into the doorway, nominally trying to break up the fight between the two men, but no one really wanted the fight to end. Me? I was ashamed. I didn't want to watch. I wanted a cigarette and I wanted to go home. Tasha, however, was hysterical.
John, get them to stop,
she cried, clinging to me, and I hugged her, amazed that she was so invested in this cockfight. It will be over soon, I said, and it was, but not in the way I'd thought. Joe apparently reached onto the little girl's bureau and grabbed the first thing he could find. It was a jump rope, and he wound it around Lev's skinny neck, pulling it tight for 1 second, but long enough to send a pileup of guests frantically onto that canopy bed, which promptly collapsed under the collective weight of all those fiction writers and poets and essayists. I am positive Joe did not want to murder Lev. It seemed that the gesture was for show, was a burlesque of anger, a kind of performance piece enacted with the most absurd prop in the world, a little girl's jump rope. Still, somebody called the police and Joe was taken away to the precinct and I had to follow in a taxi, horrified. There were reporters, there was an exhausting night of talk. And meanwhile, over in the ER at Columbia Presbyterian, Lev's neck was examined by a few nurses who had never heard of Lev Bresner and did not understand what they were dealing with here, the boiling drama of this event, the reverberations it would have, the way it would become known as a brawl, a feud, a seminal moment in the lives of the two big men. Tasha had to be treated for hysteria. She screamed and keened in the emergency room, shouting, "Mama! Papa!" though I knew that her parents had been murdered in the concentration camp long ago. The ER staff took her condition more seriously than her husband's. I heard that there was talk of hospitalizing Tasha overnight for a psych evaluation, though finally she calmed down with a sedative, and they sent her home with Lev. The story hung on for months, the bail I had to post, the court date for Joe, and then finally, Lev's very public dropping of the charges. He'd been convinced by their mutual friends to let it go. There had been soul-searching, agonizing over the whole pathetic, mortifying situation. And finally, Lev decided not to pursue the case, and the two men became friends again, apologizing to each other and embracing and weeping loudly, wiping their eyes and noses on each other's shirts,
laughing at it all, writing their respective sides of the event for a high-circulation magazine, going out to dinner again with us wives in tow. We followed them and followed them, all around New York City. Once, on a rooftop, not sure what we were doing there. It was freezing and late, but the men wanted a view of the city. Tasha Bresner turned to me and said,
"Oh, John, we have been putting up with these men for a lifetime."
"Has it been all that bad for you?" I asked. She paused, flustered.
"Not all the time," she said quickly.
"And for you?"
"No," I said.
"Ups and downs." I looked out over the buildings and the occasional flumes of smoke, and the Hudson beyond which, if you followed it north, would lead to our house, sitting silent and dark, waiting. I used to like being there, waking up in the morning to the creak and stir of the settling wood, and even to Joe with his arm flung over his head, his eyes still squeezed shut as he held on to whatever sleep he could get. I wasn't exactly lying to Tasha. I wasn't always unhappy. Joe and I had had good moments, especially early on. We'd danced together in our living room. We'd made love against a wall. We'd baked a huge pie together for a party. We'd walked everywhere, wrapped together. And later on, for a while, there was comfort, small exhalations of relief. All marriages have moments, even Tasha and Lev's, even ours. But now she and I were sad and tired as we stood on that rooftop, and though she'd tried to tell me the extent of her suffering in that moment, I didn't really want to hear it. I couldn't know that to her this lifetime was unbearable, all she'd seen and all she was left with, scrambling after a famous, intense, and ambitious man, having to climb a metal ladder in the middle of the night to be with him on the roof of a building. This was the early 80s, no later than that, because Tasha Bresner committed suicide in 1985. Even now the fact of it shocks me. She was too frightened, too unstable, and images of her murdered parents and her sisters seemed to flood her more frequently, causing her to leave rooms, to excuse herself from parties, to take various pills for a depression and anxiety that could never be quelled, until finally she swallowed a whole bottle of Xanax one night while Lev was off giving the Carl Sandburg lecture at the University of Chicago. Chicago, I'd heard, was the home of a woman Lev adored, a young divorcee who ran an elegant little bookstore on Clark Street with leather club chairs and free wine. And when he came home the next day in a splendid mood from that bounty of praise and vigorous lovemaking, he found his wife dead in their bed, her hands splayed open as if she were asking, "What else was I supposed to do?" He called us, sobbing and hysterical, and we went there. I mourned her for years and I blamed Lev, though I see that this was unfair of me. After Tasha's funeral, sitting and taking off our clothes on our bed, back to back, I said to Joe, "He should have known better." "What does that mean? Known better than to leave her to go to Chicago? He didn't know she would do what she did. How could he have known? My God, he's devastated." "It's just the whole thing," I said. "She was so needy for so many years. What happened to her as a child? Her whole family murdered. Her sisters and her parents and her grandparents, too. And then later on, Lev's thing with women? How many women were there?" "I have no idea," Joe said coldly. "It was the last straw," I said. "You can't really know what pushes someone over the brink. And you also don't know what they said between themselves," said Joe, "how they worked it out." As though he and I had ever said something like that. Had ever openly acknowledged that a man's need to be unfaithful to his wife was something to be protected and supported at all costs. Bone's biography will certainly include some of Joe's women. The book will have to mention the way Joe sought women and was equally sought by them. Most of Joe's women would never come forward to speak to a biographer, and they've never been identified before by anyone. They've preferred to press into their own memory books the time when they were younger and Joseph Castleman caught their eye. women such as Mary Cheslin, who Joe met on a porch outside a cottage at a famous summer writing conference called Butternut Peak during the summer of 1987. It seems improbable to me that Joe never realized I knew about her, when in fact she practically walked around that summer wearing a sandwich board that read, "I am fucking the great Joe Castleman. Please look through the back window of Birch Park Cottage at midnight to see us going at it like animals." I minded, mostly, but in another way I didn't mind, because I thought she was pathetic, this Mary Cheslin who had the looks of a dark-haired Rapunzel. She was young, in her mid-20s at the time, an aspiring novelist like half the participants at Butternut Peak. But she was standout good-looking. It had been the thing she'd probably always had going for her. Ever since she started school, Mary Cheslin's looks must have been the defining quality about her, the one detail that could be counted on each year. Oh, look, there's Mary at her locker. She got even prettier over the summer, if you can believe it. Of course, she ached to be a writer. Like so many women, she burned for it. All she wanted to do was to publish, and her whole life was leading toward the moment when she found an agent and a publisher, and her first book appeared. It might have happened, too, if she had been even a little talented. It might have happened if she'd figured out a way to make it happen. She was so directed that palpable ambition was released from her like kapok from a pillow. And after a while, she didn't bother to keep it in but just let everyone know. Mary Cheslin was going to be a famous writer. She'd be one of those writers you hear about, those elegant, dark-eyed women whose novels are set in Hawaii or in Tuscany, and for whom the entire town is a character, or at least that's what they say in interviews. "I keep a journal," she'd confided to Joe one day after his first workshop at Butternut Peak, and then she looked away quickly, as though she'd told him something crucial and furtive about herself, like, "I was raped by my uncle as a child." I'm making this part up. There was no journal, at least not one that I knew about. But if there had been, it would have been covered in some quilted material and had dried leaves inside it. "I actually don't know what," she said to him. "Mary Cheslin is one of the people I have never spoken to. I can't say what they talked about during intervals between the slapping of their bodies against each other in Birch Park Cottage at midnight. Though I can imagine." "I keep a journal," she said, and Joe, who always hated journals who loathed the concept of writing for the self, as opposed to writing for others to read, even that promiscuous journal filler, Virginia Woolf, must have known that those pages would one day be read by others, had looked at her and said, "Oh, well, good for you. If you want to be a writer, you've simply got to keep writing. A journal is a pretty good start." Mary Cheslin's fiction was horrible. This I actually do know, because though I was the wife, I got to look at the manuscripts he was going to deconstruct in his workshop, which would be held on Adirondack chairs in a field overlooking Butternut Peak. The good-smelling, mimeographed copies of the manuscripts sat on our old, chipped dresser in the cottage they gave us that summer, which was called Peachtree. Joe was off on some porch drinking with other writers one evening. They were both male and female. The women tended to be soft-spoken and kind to students, well, the men were an uneven lot, some powerful, others dog-like and grateful to be there, for their novels were largely ignored by the reading public. Only here in the summer could they feel big. While Joe sat on that porch, I took the stack of his student manuscripts onto our bed and began to read. There were a couple of Joe imitators in the pile, all men, mostly young, and a trembly single-spacing woman, probably old, who had written beneath the title of her 100% unpublishable story, copyright Gloria Bismarck, First North American Serial Rights, approximately 4,213 words, which was enough to break your heart rather than have contempt for. I imagined that Gloria Bismarck was a widow who lived in some suburb, and whose highlight of life was her 2 weeks at Butternut Peak. She didn't even really exist in the eyes of most of the faculty writers, because she was old and sad and ridiculous, and had bulbous veins in her legs, and for the rest of her life no one might ever touch her body or read anything she'd written, unless they'd been paid to do so. Mary Cheslin, on the other hand, immediately captured the attention of the men on the butternut faculty. Most of them lifted their heads from their manuscripts or their conversations or their Bloody Marys when she stepped onto the porch, their nostrils quivering, their mouths dropping slightly open, wanting something from this woman simply because of the sheer wall of her beauty, which was all she had that mattered. Her work was irredeemably bad. She wanted to be poetic and whispery, yet dark. She wanted to be irresistible and troubled all at once. The short story that she submitted to Joe was a mawkish girlhood reminiscence called That Firefly Summer. Though she had no talent, still she thought a lot of herself, and still my husband took her to bed in the single room she'd booked in Birch Bark and pushed up her tight little strappy dress. What was I doing at the time? I was sitting in our room, in Peachtree, stimulating my gums with a dental pick, and thinking about how many days were left before Joe and I would be able to leave Vermont. Wives are the sad sacks of any writer's conference. Wherever I went during those 12 days, when I stepped out of Peachtree and onto the gravel path, voices would call out to me in gaiety, "Morning, Joan," or, "Hey there, Joan, are you and Joe going to the picnic in the grove?" Everyone liked me because I was not only a wife, I was the alpha wife, the spouse of the alpha dog. The alpha dog, who everyone knew, was blithely cheating on me, fucking himself dizzy in birch bark, separated from Peachtree only by wildwood and silver spruce and by the great wooden dining hall with its summer camp smells and fresh out of the dishwasher glasses that warmed my orange juice each morning to approximately the temperature of the bath I took each night. In the dining hall, I sat beside Joe and across the table from other wives and their writer husbands. The occasional husband was there accompanying his writer wife, but most tended to stay away from the conference, saying they couldn't take time off from their jobs. There were a few children underfoot, too, though by now ours were fully grown and off in their own lives. All of us in the dining hall behaved with a certain jollity that is required at writers' conferences, for without it, everyone might look around and actually realize what they've gotten themselves into, all the narcissism and unpleasantness let loose among the scrub pines.
"Do you want to go into town this afternoon?"
one of the other wives asked me. She was a woman named Leanna Thorne, who looked like one of those stick insects that can change color at any given moment so as to be entirely unnoticeable. Her expression was full of hope. Her husband, Randall Thorne, used to be famous, though in recent years his novels had fallen into remainder bins everywhere, but he was friends with the director of the conference and was asked back every summer. Later in the day, when her husbands were off teaching their workshops, when Mary Cheslin was sitting near Joe, her eyes locked into his, taking down notes on every single thing he said about voice and the willing suspension of disbelief, I climbed into Leanna's beat-up Hugo with her and two other wives, Dusty Berkowitz and Janice Liedner, and we headed to town. "Free at last, free at last," Dusty Berkowitz said as the car pulled through the stone gates of Butternut Peak. "Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last." We all laughed a little, and then Janice said,
"Even Dr. King didn't have to put up with what we do."
"No, but I hear Coretta did," I said.
"It's hard being them," said Leanna finally.
"Being black?" Dusty asked.
"No, being those men," Leanna said. "Writers whom everyone wants to listen to. The kind of men who other people decide hold the key to everything. Randall tells me that he tries so hard to please everyone, but he just can't do it."
Dream on, Randall, I thought, imagining the way that Leanna's husband must certainly have envied Joe's currency in the world. We arrived in town and uncollapsed ourselves getting out of the car. This, I thought, was the kind of car that most writers' money could buy. Something squat and ugly and perhaps unsafe, with a faculty parking sticker slapped on the windshield. Although all four men had been known to be unfaithful, I believe only Joe participated in his affairs in such a vigorous way. We four wives looked at handmade scarves in a window of one of the local craft shops, Vermont County Artisans, admiring weave and texture and color, then soothed ourselves inside the store, fingering material, gathering our own sensual pleasure where we could, An eggplant-colored shawl had long silken fibers that I ran my hands through, as though they were hair. Mary Cheslin's hair was darker than that. I put my face against the shawl and nuzzled it.
"Isn't that a beauty?" the young saleswoman said, trying to be helpful. "It's made by a local craftsperson, and she happens to be blind, which I think is really neat."
What did Mary Cheslin have to offer, besides long, frequently shampooed hair and bad fiction, and a body that could be smoothed out onto a bed like this shawl, like a comforter, an offering? Joe needed that. It was blood plasma to him. "It's hard being them," Leanna Thorne had said, and I never really tried to think what exactly was so hard, what it was these men lacked, what they needed, what we couldn't give them. We gave them everything we had. All our possessions were theirs. Our children were theirs. Our lives belonged to them. Our weary, been-through-the-mill bodies were theirs, too, though more often than not they didn't want them anymore. My body wasn't bad. It still isn't. And yet, while I lay my head against an eggplant-colored fabric in a craft store, Joe was looking into the eyes of the woman he would be lying down with later in birch bark. And then, in the middle of Vermont County Artisans, I burst into tears. The other wives, alarmed, hustled me out of the store and into the little vegetarian cafe next door, where they gathered around me in solidarity.
"I admire you, I really do," said Janice after I'd admitted why I was crying. "We all see what Joe's up to, summer after summer, and yet you always seem as if you don't really care."
"We had no idea it upset you," Dusty Berkowitz murmured. "We thought you were somehow completely above it, like you knew everything but didn't give a shit. Like you were superior to the whole thing." I blew my nose into a napkin made of brown pulpy paper and let the other women take care of me. Why had Mary Cheslin gotten to me, I wondered, when last summer that student of Joe's named Holly something hadn't bothered me one bit? Why did the author of That Firefly Summer caused me to weep openly in town in front of these women I hardly knew? I'd never cried at great length before about one of Joe's affairs, or at least not in front of anyone but Joe. I'd maintained that I was never entirely threatened, because as far as I knew, most of the women he slept with weren't talented, and neither, of course, was Mary Cheslin. But what if talent didn't matter at all, at least when it came to Joe's women? What if talent wasn't simply meaningless, but was actually a liability? Did he like her more because she was a bad writer? Did it make him feel safe sliding along the body of a woman who would never be a great challenge to him? Yes, it did. I believe he spent the entire 12 days at Butternut Peak engaged in an affair with Mary. He seemed happy during those days, agreeably doing his part during the skits that the young waiters sometimes put on at dinner. "It's time to play Butternut Peak Jeopardy," the head waiter, a rotund 23-year-old fiction student, exclaimed one night, while the rest of the serving staff hummed the perky game show theme. "I'm your host, Alexander Solonitsyn Trebek," he said, to much genial laughter. There were a series of answers put to three contestants: a shy short story writer named Lucy Bloodworth, Harry Jacklin, and Joe, who was coaxed from his seat, where he had just begun tucking into a dish of bread pudding. The tone was jokey literary, and the first Daily Double was directed at Joe. Part of a paragraph from a recent novel of his was going to be read aloud, and he would be asked to finish it. "I quote," said the head waiter, "Shirley Breen was not a covetous woman. No one had ever said of her, 'There goes Shirley Breen, desire of things she cannot have.' In her life there was only one thing she wanted that she had not been able to get." The head waiter paused dramatically. This was an easy one. The answer, in the form of a question, was, "What is a shot glass that had been drunk from by Mae West?" At least one quarter of the dining hall could have shouted those words in unison. But Joe just sat there in front of all of them, scratching his head and looking embarrassed. "Oh, God," he finally said, "I'm royally screwed now. You've all learned my terrible secret." "And what secret would that be?" asked the head waiter. I watched Joe with curiosity. That I've got a bad case of Alzheimer's, he said. Can't even remember my own writing a minute after I finish it. Somebody shoot me now. In the vegetarian cafe with the three other wives, I wept and wept, and they were a mass of heads and elbows, comforting me or trying to. I just feel so humiliated, I said, getting up every morning and stepping outside the building, knowing what everyone else knows. Do you all think I'm ridiculous? A pathetic figure?
No, no, they cried. Not at all. Everyone admires you.
But who were these women? By default, they were my friends, my companions, these weary wives with their own careers that people tried hard to be interested in.
How's the social work going, Leanna?
A conference student asked her at a picnic one afternoon, though there was no answer that could have kept his eye from leaping away from her and onto the more desirable targets, famous novelists spitting watermelon seeds in that grove.
How's the refugee work going, Joan?
An older, shy female poet named Jeannie asked me another time, for she'd heard about my occasional involvement with the relief organization. I told her just enough to be conversational and no more, though she seemed disappointed and truly wanted to hear. Joe had exaggerated my involvement with the charity over the years, trying to make me sound as though I was engaged in something in a way that would command quiet respect. I have nothing, I said to the wives, and they told me I was wrong. I had so much. I contributed to the world. I was a positive presence. They'd always thought I was stylish and intelligent, to use Janice Liedner's words.
It's like you have a whole other life going on inside you,
said Dusty Berkowitz. We all do, I said.
I don't, she said with her rolling, self-conscious laugh. What you see is what you get.
Dusty Berkowitz, 55, her chest freckled from sun exposure, her hair as red as a leprechaun's, no longer existed for her husband. Janice Liedner still existed for her own husband, though only in outline, the idea of her, rather than the particulars. Leanna Thorne, deeply melancholy and bland, had a husband who longed to be part of the men's club and who continually elbowed his way in, to the exclusion of any other activities or interests. And me, blonde, thin, aging but preserved in the acidity of this long marriage. The marital juices kept me alive, kept me going. Joe and I swam in a jar together. I swam alone whenever he went off to kiss the tender parts of Mary Cheslin. Then, tired, he always swam back to me. There he was at 3 a.m. that morning, slowly opening the door of our room in Peachtree and appearing with the hall light behind him. Joan, he said, you up? He came into the room, bringing a draft of cigarette smoke with him, much of it absorbed into his hair, his sweater, pores of his skin. I lifted my head from the deep sleep I'd been in. Yes, I always said, even when it wasn't really true. I'm up. He hoisted himself onto the bed beside me, that smoky, clouded man, too old for blue jeans even then, but wearing them anyway. His eyes inflamed from the smoke that had filled the room he'd been in, that party with godly writers and lowly students coming together, and then the private party afterward, in Birch Bark, when he climbed onto a bed identical to this one, with a woman who bore no resemblance to me whatsoever. At 3 in the morning that summer, and the summers that preceded it and the summers that followed, we were together. A husband and wife united in the foggy middle of a Vermont night. Bats circled the pines all around our cottage, and sometimes hung like change purses from the roof of our veranda, and the night bristled with forest-bright animal eyes, and the arrhythmic clicking of strange bugs that I hoped never to see, but which I'd simply agreed to live among for 12 days. He was with me. We slept together and we woke up together, day after day, which is a lot more than I can say for Mary Cheslin, who, after that summer, was never heard from as a writer, and who, in the Butternut Peak alumni newsletter, recently described herself this way. "I'm divorced," writes Mary Cheslin. "No kids, never published my novel, sigh, but I'm happily working for a small educational software company in Providence, Rhode Island, which, believe it or not, actually gives me a chance to use some of the creative skills I learned all those summers ago in Vermont." Mary Cheslin will appear in Bone's biography, at least in some vaguely described way. So, too, will other women from Joe's visiting stints at universities, as well as occasional hangers-on and New York publicists. There were beautiful young women in gauzy blouses and cowboy boots, and stylish recent college graduates looking for jobs in publishing. In addition to the women, Joe's attempted strangulation of Lev will make it into the biography. And so will Joe's heart attack, and eventual valve replacement. This is a distinctly unsexy portion, for instead of jump rope weapons or rewards or couplings, there is only a miserable scene in a restaurant called The Cracked Crab in the winter of 1991. There we were, six male writers and some wives, the men having achieved various footholds of success in their writing lives, their pitons dug deep into a rock wall, hairlines receded or vanished, or else the hair itself staying resiliently wiry and Einstein clownish. Joe, in this group, still occupied the center. He wasn't the loudest. That would have been Martin Beneker, with his roar and flying hail of spittle. And he wasn't the richest. Definitely Ken Wooten, whose urban and chiseled espionage novels had all been turned into movies. Nor was he the most intelligent, not by far. Lev had that role. He'd lunged for it. Joe had a special, indefinable position among these men, a kind of quiet seniority. Joe loved to talk, and once in a while he loved to cook thick, undifferentiated stews that he could stand over for hours, pouring red wine into the pot and tossing in some meat and bones and the occasional handful of parsley. He loved to read, and listen to jazz, and eat his snowballs, and drink at a tavern, and play pool. We sat at a large round table at the Cracked Crab that night. The surface had been lined with white butcher's paper, and was covered with crabs, as though we'd stumbled upon a colony of them. There they were, a mess of claws and jointed legs doused with a spray of Old Bay seasoning. Beer bottles lifted and lowered during animated talk left their rings all over the paper. As usual, the wives had somehow banded together from their separate seats, straining forward to talk, maybe discussing some new Chinese language film, and the men were joshing and boasting in their usual way, and there was the incessant, almost soothing sound of crab cartilage being crushed or pulled, when suddenly, with a mouthful of food, Joe reared back in his chair and said, "Shit." Then his chair slammed forward to the floor, and his face smashed down onto the butcher paper, and all of us leaped forward. "Are you choking?" boomed Maria Jacqueline, in a voice she'd learned from CPR class, and Joe made the slightest movement with his head that indicated no. His eyes were squeezed tight in pain, and his hands clasped his chest, and he seemed to stop breathing, and immediately the men were hoisting his body up onto the table, right into the middle of the crustacean bed, where they fell upon him, the way they'd done long ago during the fight with Lev. Lev Bresner, by now a widower for years and still sexually active, but more depressed than ever, took over, starting the tilting of the head and the application of his lips to Joe's, and then the pounding of Joe's chest, and the next thing I knew, paramedics had pushed through the wooded back room of the Cracked Crab and had Joe on a stretcher with an oxygen mask over his face. Someone put an arm around me. I heard a mesh of voices, and I reached out toward Joe, but he was already being wheeled away. 5 months later, after a long, cranky recovery from what had actually been a fairly mild heart attack, Joe required surgery to replace one of his human valves with a pig's. He lay in our bed in Wethermill and read letters and novels, talking on the phone to various people around the world. Both of our daughters came and stayed at the house a couple of times, trying to cheer me up and be helpful to their dad. Even David telephoned, and though he didn't ask directly about Joe, I knew that was why he was calling. I clung to Joe that year, extremely frightened. I forgot his flaws. They flew away as quickly as a taste of that meal. I've never eaten crab again. I fretted at his bedside, and I wished desperately for his recovery, and I got what I wished for. On our final night in Finland, Joe and I walked up the wide marble steps of the Helsinki Opera House side by side, my arm in his, surrounded by the chatter of cameras which weren't meant only for us. Anyone of prominence in Finland was here tonight. All the writers and artists and members of government, the people with curiously interesting names like Simo Ratia, Carlo Pietella, Hannes Vatanen. The names rang similarly, seductively, and the faces bore the same high color and fine bone structure. Everyone's teeth looked strong and even, too, as though one orthodontist serviced the entire country. Men and women filed into the opera house in their bulky Nordic parkas. Only after they had entered and stripped down to their evening dresses could you see how prepared they were for an evening of high couture. Here was a high point, the annual release from a frozen static state, the tiny crack in the ice that let in the world. And the crack in the ice this year was in the name of Joseph Castleman, a small, overweight man in a tuxedo, walking beside me up a set of shallow steps and into the gilded light of the Helsinki Opera House. I was seated in a box beside the President of Finland and his wife. While Joe was ushered backstage, I was formally introduced to the President, a man of my age named Mr. Timo Christian, with a stern face not unlike Finnish architecture. He wore one of those diagonal sashes fashioned of multicolor silk. His wife, Mrs. Carita Christian, slightly younger, dressed in black with a string of amethysts around her neck, sat frozen in place beside him. They had nothing to say to each other, or so it seemed, and they didn't even try to give the illusion of rapport. Presidents serve for 6 years in Finland. This was the beginning of Christian's 5th year in office, and both he and his wife looked very tired. Finally, Mrs. Christian took it upon herself to speak to me. There we were, wife to wife. "So, Mrs. Castleman," she said in careful English, "you are enjoying your stay here in Helsinki?" "Oh, yes," I said. "What are your impressions of the Finnish people?" she wanted to know. And I spoke a little about their quiet pride, their good eye, their elegant simplicity, all of which seemed to be the right responses, for she appeared pleased. "And how about you, Mrs. Christian?" I said. "What is your life like here in Helsinki?" The president's wife was confused. I immediately realized that the question probably seemed insolent and strange. Or maybe she was just unused to such direct interest. "My life?" she began uncertainly. And then she quickly looked around to see who might be listening. No one was. The president was talking to one of his cabinet members, a man with an enormous blonde mustache. "My life," Carita Christian went on in a quiet, controlled voice, "is so very unhappy." I stared at her. Had I heard her right? Maybe she said her life was so very happy instead. How could I find out? Her face gave nothing away, but appeared as placid as it had been moments before. The lights dimmed just then, and everyone in our box and in the entire audience grew silent. Mrs. Carita Christian, the First Lady of Finland, turned to face forward as the heavy, scalloped curtains were pulled upward on the stage, revealing a small sea of men that included my husband. One or two women sat among them, their dresses providing the only bright bits of color. Soon Joe was given a medal by the acting president of the Finnish Academy of Letters, Tuva Hallinen, the man who had first telephoned to inform us that Joe had won the prize. The gold disc hung on white silk, the disc engraved with a miniature copy of Kalevala, and a pair of hands holding it open, and even from all the way up here in the opera box, I could make out the metal's winking light. Short selections from several of Joe's novels were read aloud by a film actress, who flipped back her hair often as she read in a sonorous voice. And then, finally, Joe stood up. "Good evening," he began, "and thank you for your kind welcome." He tipped his head in the direction of the Finnish Academy. "Members of the Finnish Academy, I would like to say that I am deeply grateful and moved." And then, slowly, he raised his head in the direction of the box. "President Christian," he said, "thank you for honoring me in your beautiful country." "Blah, blah, blah," he went on. "No, that's unfair of me." The words were reasonable, though mostly uninteresting. I listened hard. He hadn't let me see his speech beforehand. It was important to him that he wrote it himself and that no one else offered an opinion before he came to Finland. "I felt, ever since I arrived here," he said, "what a tonic this land is after the harsh locus of resentment and plenty that is otherwise known as the United States. In these days since terrorism has accelerated its global pace," I was mortified that he was talking about terrorism. It was such an easy subject, an all-purpose cheap one. All you had to do was invoke the specter of terrorism, and everyone dutifully went somber on you. Lips pursed. People bowed their heads slightly. Couldn't he have come up with something more original? Joe went on in this vein, quoting Rilke and Saul Bellow and Baudelaire's Les Fleurs du Mal. And his speech meandered predictably through the war against terrorism, through the windy caves of Afghanistan and the Middle East, and wrapped itself around the world until it returned home again. He was almost done. Joe paused here, and then his eyes moved suddenly over to me as he said, "I'd like to say a few words about my wife, Joan." Everyone dutifully looked upward, their heads tilted toward me. "My wife Joan," Joe repeated, "is truly my better half." "Don't," I thought. "Don't do this to me. I asked you not to." "She has made it possible for me to find the stillness inside myself, as well as the noise, to write my novels," he said. "Without her, I am certain I would not be standing up here tonight. I would instead be at home, staring at a blank piece of paper with my mouth open in stupefaction." There was indulgent laughter. Of course he would have been up here anyway, the audience thought. Yet how admirable it was for the winner of the Helsinki Prize to be so generous toward his wife. To acknowledge her like this as he stood on stage to accept this award for a long, hard labor on the fiction chain gang. He'd been breaking rocks apart, and there I was, wiping his brow, offering him cool drinks. He'd been nearly prostrate from the heat and the strain of being a novelist, and yet I was always there, stripping away his soiled shirt, bringing him a clean one, helping him slip his arms into it, doing up the buttons myself, urging him on when he needed encouragement, lying beside him at night telling him, "You can do it," even as his ankles were shackled together, and he was exhausted and in tears. "You can do it," we wives said. "You can do it." And when they actually did do it, we were as happy as mothers whose babies have taken a first, shaky step, letting go of the furniture forever. Those well-meaning Finns regarded me, those people who had given my husband a check worth $525,000. They gave us their marca, and they smiled up at me, nodding and praising the charms and subtle skills of the wife. Everyone knows how women soldier on, how women dream up blueprints, recipes, ideas for a better world, and then sometimes lose them on the way to the crib in the middle of the night, on the way to the Stop and Shop or the bath. They lose them on the way to greasing the path on which their husband and children will ride serenely through life. "But it's their choice," Bone might say. "They make a choice to be that kind of wife, that kind of mother. Nobody forces them anymore. That's all over now. We had a women's movement in America. We had Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem with her aviator glasses and frosted parentheses of hair. We're in a whole new world now. Women are powerful. Valerian Clonuck will probably be standing on this very stage in a couple of years, wearing traditional Inuit garb and reflecting upon her childhood in that notorious sod and snow igloo. Some women don't make that choice, it's true. They live another life entirely. Lee, the journalist I met in Vietnam. Brenda, the prostitute. Or else they work out some version involving elaborate child care, or a husband who doesn't mind staying home all day with an infant. A husband who lactates, perhaps. Or maybe they don't even want babies, some of these women, and life opens out to them in an endless field of work. And once in a while, the world responds in a big way, letting them in, giving them a key, a crown. It does happen, it does. But usually, it doesn't. "You sound bitter," Bone would say. "That's because I am," I would tell him. Everyone needs a wife. Even wives need wives. Wives tend, they hover. Their ears are twin-sensitive instruments, satellites picking up the slightest scrap of dissatisfaction. Wives bring broth. We bring paperclips. We bring ourselves and our pliant, warm bodies. We know just what to say to the men who, for some reason, have a great deal of trouble taking consistent care of themselves or anyone else. "Listen," we say, "everything will be okay." And then, as if our lives depend on it, we make sure it is. Chapter 6 Drunk. Joe and I were drunk in a way that is allowed, even expected, following moments of great preening triumph. You would have seen us in that opera house at the banquet and thought, from the way he leaned in to whomever he was talking to and tilted his head and slapped his knee, that we too were Finns, drunken Finns, trying to forget the encroaching half-year of darkness. Happy Finns, carefree Finns, huckleberry Finns. Joe had received his award and given his remarks, and we'd spent the evening at the banquet, circulating, being circulated around, meeting the luminaries of not only the Scandinavian countries but also the clusters of novelists, journalists and publishers who'd been imported from London, Paris, Rome. The ceilings were high in the opera house's atrium, where extremely long tables had been set up and draped in linen, and the acoustics amplified the excited multilingual jabber. Toasts took place in many languages, without interpreters, and Joe and I smiled and raised our glasses along with everyone else, never really knowing what we were toasting, what we were signing on for, what we were gamely laughing at. The president and his wife left early. Someone mentioned in passing that Christian liked to watch Sky TV every night and then go right to sleep, and that he never deviated from this strict routine, not even once a year for the winner of the Helsinki Prize. I wanted to say to his wife, "Oh, couldn't you stay on without him?" But it was too late. They'd been swept away. Back down those marble steps and perhaps into some waiting coach driven by reindeer. Hours later, Joe and I finally left too, in the company of 24 agreeable publishers and writers and dignitaries who begged Joe not to end the evening just yet, but to let it go on and on a bit longer. This one special night that, like Passover, was different from all other Finnish nights. Passover. A holiday that few of these people would know a good deal about. "Yes, yes, that is the one on which the Jewish people recline, no?" They were charming and lively, wanting to discuss American fiction and geopolitics with Joe, wanting to talk more about terrorism and anxiety about the future. In a fleet of limousines, we rode off to a very old, classic brasserie in the middle of the city. The management had been told we would be coming and was prepared, for when we arrived the rooms were festooned with flowers and ornaments and brightly lit ice mountains on which crayfish lay. But none of us could eat much, for the banquet earlier had been an embarrassment of riches, with bricks of foie gras, and individual game birds and a geometrical array of cheeses. Some of the members of the Finnish Academy were now patiently teaching Joe the opening lines of Kalevala in both Finnish and English. Slurring, they looped their arms around one another and recited. Joe was in the middle of the crowd, beaming, impish, his voice louder than anyone's. He'd eaten too much tonight. I'd seen him shoveling in the solid blocks of trans fats and animal flesh with its scorched jackets of skin, and cheese upon cheese, followed by the best wines of the world, the bottles brought up from deep down inside some Nordic cellar. I'd watched him pack it in earlier, saw him with his mouth open so wide that I could view his dental history, the silver and the gold packed into the hollows, and the long, dark throat that led down toward his imperfect heart with its second-hand valve. Our business was almost done, I thought, as I tossed back another drink and watched him. Our entire transaction was nearly complete. The endless exchange of fluids, of vital information, the creation of children, the buying of cars, the taking of vacations, the winning of prizes in far-flung places, the winning of this prize. The effort of it all. God, what effort. Enough already, I should say to him. Enough of this. Let me go now and not have to wake up beside your satisfied face every morning for the next decade, and your well-fed stomach that deprives you of the sight of your own penis, curled in wait. I'm going back to the hotel, I whispered to him. I'm ready. I've had it for the night. He was telling a story to the entire table about growing up in Brooklyn. I heard the word brisket spoken, and then a translator gave an explanation to everyone in Finnish about what a brisket was, and I knew I really wanted to be out of there. I'd heard all of Joe's stories many times, the unadorned or embellished tales. Joe turned. You sure? He asked. And I said yes, I was tired. The driver would take me and Joe should stay, which of course he would. Everyone bade me a fervent good night. All these new friends I would never see again. The elegant men and women of this lovely, brave country. Brave, I thought, for being located so far from the rest of the world it partially emulated. Away from horror, from easy thrills. Brave for knowing it would soon be put to sleep for an entire winter, only to be roused again with the bears when the Earth's rotation brought it briefly into sunlight. I slid across the back seat of the limousine and the driver started us toward the Intercontinental Hotel. It was after 3 a.m., and we drove slowly past the harbor, where a boxy, aging Russian ocean liner, the Konstantin Simonov, I read on its side, was docked beside a sleeker Norwegian one. I remember looking at the enormous ships and listening politely as the driver told me some bit of waterfront history. But then I succumbed to my drunkenness, my head a punch bowl filled with various Finnish liquors. I lay down in the back seat with my feet up and thought about the pleasure of leaving a party alone. Often the Siamese twinship of marriage keeps you waiting in rooms you'd rather vacate. But tonight, I was out of there on my own. He was my other half, and I wanted us divided. Are you really going to leave him? A voice asked. It was a woman speaking to me from inside the drunken punch bowl. I could see her without even bothering to open my eyes. She was someone I hadn't seen in over 40 years. Elaine Moselle, the novelist who'd given that reading at Smith. She looked the same. Her hair full, her face red. She was the same, a frozen ghost. And she was still drunk, but I was drunker. Yes, I said to her, I am.
Did you get what you want?
She asked.
I'm not sure what it was she wanted, said someone else, who was quickly revealed to be my mother, hovering nearby. That man was a Jew, she continued. That was her first mistake. My mother's hair still stank of the beauty parlor, even 18 years after her death. In the afterlife, then, there were beauty parlors with upright lost souls sitting under inverted cones and staring at nothing,
The thoughts blasted right out of their heads in the heat.
She wanted to be by his side,
another person said, and I saw that it was poor Tasha Bresner, the suicide. A small, scrawny woman, her hands still fashioning